Have you discussed 14?
We actually got past it. Well, I'm going to ask, let's just go through it again quickly as review. What kind of proteins are shown here? What are these? Types of proteins. Right, they're transport proteins. And why do we need transport proteins? Well, more specifically.
So that particles can get in and out of the
cell. Yes, in and out of the cell, you mean? And why would it be not possible for a particle to do that?
Too big
is one reason. And by the way, when I mean impossible, I mean impossible to go through the directly through the phospholipid bilayer. And technically, it's not impossible, it's just unlikely. Yeah. What is it? Right. A particle can be either too big or too polar or both, and it therefore will not easily get through directly through the phospholipid bilayer. So we have to have transport proteins to allow those kinds of things through, either into or out of the cell. What is the functional distinction between the two categories we're seeing here? What distinguishes a carrier protein from a channel protein?
One matches
the right, that's what I was looking at for functional distinction. The functional distinction is based on how they work. And the difference is that a carrier protein operates by changing conformation. What's conformation? The shape of the protein, whereas a channel protein is a tunnel. The shape of that tunnel doesn't change. There might be a gate, maybe not. So the gate could open or close or just not even be there, but the tunnel itself doesn't change shape. So if there's a gradient in place, things are going to move. And by the way, for a channel protein, the direction through which something travels is determined how? What's going to determine whether the thing goes into the cell or out of the cell? Right, the concentration gradient, and that is all that makes the difference. I mean, that's the only thing that determines it. A channel is an open hole. Right, you put a hole in a barrel of water that's full of water, the water's going to come out, not go in. It's because it's going down its gravitational gradient. In that case, it's gravitational gradient. So what I'm pointing out here is that since a channel protein is just an open tunnel, it can operate only for passive transport. Active transport would be impossible for a channel protein because it would be like opening up a hole in a barrel full of water in hopes of getting water into the barrel, right? You can't move something against its gradient when it's coming down its gradient more easily through that hole. A carrier protein, on the other hand, can operate for either active transport or passive transport. A carrier protein, by definition, temporarily binds the particle, whatever it is, because that's what causes the shape change in the protein that allows it then to be dropped off on the other side of the membrane to either get into or out of. This example shows it coming in, but it could operate in either direction. But just because there's a binding of the particle to the protein and a shape change, that does not necessarily mean it's active transport. In this example, this is still passive transport. You can see that there's a higher concentration outside than inside, so there's a gradient, and it's going down its gradient. That's still passive transport. It's just being helped through by this protein. The protein is not forcing it All right, so a carrier protein can operate either for passive or active transport. Active transport, though, cannot use a channel protein. If it's going to be active transport, it has to be a carrier protein doing that job. And in addition to that, for it to be active transport, by definition, some energy has to be supplied. It's not enough to have a carrier protein. If you're going to move something against its gradient, you not only need a carrier protein, but you also need to supply outside energy to do that. Okay, well, 15 is an example of an active transporter. Now, active transport proteins or active transporters are usually called pumps by analogy with macroscopic pumps, right? You don't have to force water downhill. It'll spill downhill for you because of the gravitational gradient. But sometimes it's useful to move water uphill. It's never going to happen on its own, right? Because you're trying to move that water against its gradient. It's against its gravitational gradient in that place, in that case. So you have to force that to happen with the expenditure of outside energy. And the things that use that outside energy to force water uphill are pumps. That's why we call active transporters that are in membrane, biological membranes, pumps. So when you hear the word pump, you should equate that in your mind with active transporter and the process of active transport. This is just one of many pumps that are found in biology. And this is the one. This is the kind of pump that is most prevalent in your body. You have quadrillions of these things operating in you for your entire life. This is the sodium-potassium exchange pump. And all pumps, since they're active transporters, require energy. Well, you have so many of these operating in all of your living cells that by some estimates, the amount of energy you put into just operating these pumps for a lifetime accounts for 40% of your energy budget. 40% of the reason you eat, in other words, goes into powering these pumps continuously. These are not the only kinds of pumps you have, but this is the one you have most of. And the sodium-potassium exchange pump is actually two pumps in one, because both of these two different types of particles, sodium ions and potassium ions, are being pumped. But by that, I mean both of them are moving against their gradient. That's what pumps do. They're able to move things against their gradient in the opposite direction compared to what they want to diffuse in. That's why it requires energy. So in your body, the extracellular fluid, the stuff that's outside of your cells, has a much higher sodium ion concentration than the inside of the cells. And that's just the opposite for potassium ions. The intracellular fluid has a higher potassium ion concentration than the extracellular fluid does. And that's because these pumps operate. In other words, pumps create and maintain gradients by pumping particles. Right, they take particles from where they are already at low concentration. They're already sparse. And they put them in a place where they're already plentiful, already a high concentration. In other words, pumps stockpile things. Rather than allowing them to spread out, they put them all in a pile, a high concentration on one side of the membrane. And by doing that at the expense of energy, the gradient is actually established by the pump. Now that's important because of something I told you in the lab when we talked about this one. I gave you those three slides, which is that any gradient, whether it's a concentration gradient or not, is a form of stored energy and therefore a useful thing. It's potentially useful. It's potential energy, and it can do some work for you if things are set up correctly. You know, speaking of the water pump, if you put in the exertion of hauling buckets of water, which are heavy, upstairs. You're moving water against gravity, against its gravitational gradient. And that, you know, that takes the energy that you, of effort you have to put into that. But by doing that, you now have water at a higher gravitational potential, and you could allow it to spill downward onto something like a water wheel, spinning it to do some work for you. So gradients in general are forms of stored energy, and they therefore can pay off. Well, that's why we have so many of these pumps. It's not because we just want more sodium on the outside and want more potassium on the inside. Those gradients allow things to happen that wouldn't happen if it weren't for those gradients being put in place. But this particular pump, the sodium-potassium exchange pump, starts out in this shape. This kind of goes clockwise as a cycle, in a position, an open position toward the interior of the cell, allowing sodiums to bind. Now, you can't tell from the picture, but as I said, the sodium-potassium ion concentration is already low inside the cell, but there still are a lot of sodium ions, and they will bind. That, of course, causes a shape change, which allows for a dephosphorylation of ATP. That's when the energy is spent. And that causes the protein to change shape, spilling the sodium out onto the outside where it's already in high concentration. Now it's even higher concentration. And when those sodiums leave, that allows potassium from the outside, which is already sparsely populated with potassium ions, to come in. And another shape change drops them off on the other side, and it just keeps going around and around. But you have to spend ATP for this to happen every time, which is why it's such an expensive thing to run your quadrillions of these. That is the basis of active transport, though. Yeah?
Does active transport have to go against the gradient for it to be considered active transport, or can it?
Technically, no, it doesn't. It almost always does, but technically it's possible to use active transport to just make transport down a gradient even faster. I just don't know how many good examples there are of that, but it's not impossible, though. All right, 16. So here we are looking at passive and active transport in pictures to really explain what I've already told you in words. Passive transport is diffusion. Diffusion is always passive. It is passive transport. But that can happen in different ways depending on what the particle is that's diffusing. If the particle is small enough and nonpolar enough, like whatever these purple spheres represent, then they have no problem being around those nonpolar tails of the phospholipid bilayer. And those kind of things, therefore, can just diffuse directly through the phospholipid bilayer. In other words, without the help of any transport protein. Now, they're going to go into the cell or out of the cell based purely on the direction of the gradient. So there has to be a gradient to exist, remember, for any net diffusion to occur. But there is a gradient in place here, so they're coming in this case. That is just simple diffusion. Other things that are either too big, too polar, or both require help because they can't get directly through the phospholipid bilayer. They therefore need to be helped or facilitated. That's facilitated diffusion, but the phrase facilitated diffusion still tells you that it's still diffusion and therefore still passive, even though a transport protein is involved. And that can happen in two different ways. It could be a channel protein, which can operate only for diffusion, remember. Or facilitated diffusion could also involve a carrier protein. It's passive, though, only if the energy required for this is built in as in the form of a gradient. These things are moving down their gradient, so this is still passive, even though it's using a carrier protein. So facilitated diffusion, if there's a transport protein involves simple diffusion. If not, well, that is all passive, though. Active transport, on the other hand, is always going to involve a transport protein, which needs to grab a hold of these particles so that they can be forced in the opposite direction from the direction they want to move in based on their gradient. And that, of course, takes outside energy. Not always in the form of ATP, but usually. There's other ways that could happen. For instance, sunlight could drive that as well in certain kinds of cells. Okay, so carrier protein is the only possibility there, right? If you have a channel protein, it's never going to operate for active transport because it's just a hole and it's going to leak in down the gradient, not up the gradient. But if you grab on and force them in the opposite direction like a carrier protein can, if you give it energy, then you have active transport. Okay, well, 17 is another example of active transport. This involves a different kind of pump. You have these pumps in your body as well, especially in your kidneys. These are proton pumps. Plants, for instance, use these more than any other kind of pump. They don't have a lot of sodium-potassium exchange pumps like we do. They mostly operate on proton pumps. But in any case, whatever kind of organism this is in, the point is that it's a proton pump. And when I say proton, what other things come to mind? What are the three things that you should equate? No? Though protons are, well, yes, I'm glad that brought that up. They are fellow subatomic particles. But what I mean by equate is a proton is the same thing as what other two things?
Hydrogen, positive charge, acidity.
Hydrogen ion. A hydrogen ion, not a hydrogen atom, a hydrogen ion is exactly the same thing as a proton, which is also equated, hopefully in your mind, with H+, the symbol for the hydrogen ion. So H+, proton, and hydrogen ion all mean the same thing. That's why it's called a proton pump here, but we have H+s. And you see why a hydrogen ion is a proton? I mean, do you see why they are the same thing? A hydrogen atom is a proton and an electron, right? If it forms an ion by losing that electron, all you have left is a proton. So it's the, by far, the simplest possible ion. Well, this is active transport, and that's how we would usually just describe this, just the phrase active transport. But we could also more specifically describe this, what's happening here, as primary active transport, simply to distinguish it from another possibility, which is secondary active transport, which I'll show you in the next slide. We wouldn't usually bother to say primary active transport, but there is such a thing as secondary active transport, and so I want to use both phrases. What makes this primary active transport, though, is that that source of external energy that's always required for active transport is used directly at this transporter. Notice the ATP, which is the external source of energy. That's being directly used to drive this pump, and therefore this is primary active transport. And how can you tell, even if you didn't have the ATP here, that this is operating as a pump? What about the gradient?
There's more on the outside.
Right, you can see from the picture that there's a higher concentration of protons outside the cell than inside the cell, and they're being moved from inside to outside. So they're being moved from low concentration to high concentration. The only way that could ever happen is by active transport. You have to force that to happen. Okay, so that's what the proton pump does. It establishes this proton gradient by doing this pumping. You wouldn't have this proton gradient if it weren't for the pump doing this pumping. But now that you have the proton gradient, as I said earlier, it is a form of potential energy. In other words, a lot of the energy that you had stored in ATP and that you spent to power this pump is now reinvested in the form of the proton gradient. It's not a total waste of energy. You use the energy, but you put it into the form of a gradient, so it can still be used for you just as a different form of energy, the gradient itself, which is where 18 comes in, slide 18. You see this proton pump again. That's exactly the same proton pump that we just looked at. Now, there are many, many of them in each cell. Don't get the idea that there's just one, but that's the same pump. And so it, by itself, is operating via primary active transport because the external source of energy is directly driving that pump. Okay? But on the bottom, we have a different pump, a different protein, but it's also a pump which should, in your mind, equate with something else is being moved against its gradient, because pump always means active transport. In this case, notice it's called a sucrose proton co-transporter. Sucrose is what kind of thing?
Disaccharide.
Right, disaccharide, which means what?
Sugar.
It's two monosaccharides hooked together, right? Yes, this is sugar. What are the two sugars? Anyone remember? Right, glucose and fructose hooked together via glycosidic linkage is sucrose. We call it table salt. I mean table sugar. Well, they're both white. Anyway, sucrose, you can't tell from this picture because they didn't draw enough sucrose molecules. But sucrose is already in higher concentration inside the cell than outside. And notice it's coming into the cell, sucrose is, which means sucrose is being moved against its gradient. Therefore, sucrose, by definition, is being pumped. Pumping requires energy, outside energy. But notice no ATP is driving this sucrose pump. What is the source of energy driving the sucrose pump? Not the proton pump so much. The gradient. Yes, the proton gradient, which I told you gradients are sources of energy, is what directly drives this sucrose pump. Okay? What we have here is a co-transporter, which means a protein that simultaneously, or more or less simultaneously, transports two different kinds of particles at the same time. In this case, a proton and a sucrose molecule. All right? But what is happening here is that the protons that are moving through the co-transporter are moving down their gradient, right? You see that? They're coming back into the cell. That's down their gradient because they're going from high concentration outside to low inside. What's another way of saying they're going down their gradient? Right. They are diffusing. The hydrogen ions are diffusing. That's passive from their point of view. But the way this protein is arranged, when the hydrogen ions diffuse through this co-transporter, sucrose gets dragged along for the ride against its gradient. All right? You know, if using this water wheel example I was using before, which would be the payoff for putting the effort into lifting the water up. If you had something, if you had a rope wrapped around the axle of the water wheel, spilling the water down could lift something from that's on the other end of that rope, because the water wheel will turn and it will lift that thing, right? So you're using the water gradient, the gravitational gradient, to do some work for you in that case. Well, here you're using the proton gradient to do the work of pumping sucrose against its concentration gradient. And the reason this is secondary active transport, has to be active transport because something's moving against its gradient, but it's secondary active transport because the original outside source of energy is not spent directly here. It was spent before to operate the proton pump, and then the proton pump established the gradient that directly drives the co-transporter for sucrose. You see the how it's secondary? Yeah, go ahead.
So How do they hold the sucrose? Do they attract to each other or something?
Based on shape, just like in most cases of things binding to proteins. Now, it's not purely shape. It's not as simple as like a lock and key mechanism. So it's also other things like charge and stuff like that, but it's mostly shape. You see the difference, though, between primary and secondary active transport. Tell me if not, because a lot of people don't understand secondary at first.
So yeah. For the secondary transport, does it have to have something going down its gradient, or is that just one example?
I don't know of any other examples. Yes, it involves the establishment of a gradient, and that's what the primary active transport is. It establishes the gradient, and then the gradient itself is then used to drive secondary active transport of something. All right. That brings us to 19. And 19 is largely a review. We've talked about much of this already. What did I say are the three major categories of ways in which things can be put into cells or taken out of cells? Three major transport processes. Vesicular transport. Active and passive. We just got done talking about passive and active. We've talked about vesicular transport already, but let's review it again. Vesicular is just the adjective of vesicle. So vesicular transport means transport into or out of a cell using a vesicle to do that. And what's different about it compared to passive or active transport is that vesicular transport doesn't actually involve something going through the membrane. It's kind of a cheating mechanism in that respect. Because if something is outside of the cell, like this chunk of brown thing, whatever it is, and the plasma membrane wraps around it and then seals off on the other side to form a vesicle, now that brown stuff is inside the cell, but it never went through any piece of membrane. You see that? So it's a way to get around this need to go through a membrane, vesicular transport is. And so vesicular transport is the biggest set in terms of describing things. It's the most general term. What are the two major kinds of vesicular transport based only on direction of travel? In other words, based only on whether things are coming in or going out of the cell. I think we went over this, didn't we? Yeah, well, there are two major categories of vesicular transport based simply on whether the thing is going into the cell or out of the cell.
Endonectase?
Well, those are prefaces, not words. Right, endocytosis and exocytosis. Endocytosis is any vesicular transport that brings things into the cell. Exocytosis is any vesicular transport that puts things out of the cell. And that's the only thing that those words tell you. They don't say anything about what is being transported, just the direction. Okay? But usually, we can further subdivide endocytosis based on what it actually is that's coming into the cell. What are those two words, the two kinds of endocytosis that we already discussed? Those are the ones that mean literally cell eating and cell drinking.
Pinocytosis and phagocytosis?
Yeah, now what is pinocytosis? Which of the two?
Drinking.
Right. Pinocytosis is cell drinking, so to speak, or that's what it literally means. And phagocytosis is cell eating. So it's endocytosis in both cases. something's being brought into the cell with a vesicle, or using a vesicle to do that. But if it's a solid chunk or chunks, like this brown thing, then we call it phagocytosis. By analogy of things that are solid, we say we eat, and things that are liquid, we say we drink. So this, it's the same process, though, really, right? You're just using a vesicle to bring things in. But in pinocytosis, the cell is more or less taking a little sip of the environment, of the liquid environment. That's the distinction for those two words. And we didn't talk about this third category, which is kind of a special category of endocytosis. It's called receptor-mediated endocytosis, but before we get to that, let me just say that for this pinocytosis figure, for instance, that there are cells that can just be doing this more or less continuously, forming little vesicles all the time, bringing in little sips from the environment without knowing what the contents are, just continuously taking things in. On the other hand, some cells don't want to bother doing that unless the correct stuff is in the environment that they're interested in bringing into the cell. And that's where receptor-mediated endocytosis comes in play. It involves these Y-shaped proteins, which are receptor proteins. They have just the right shape to fit the shape of a particular substance that the cell is interested in bringing into the cell, to itself. So if that stuff is not present in the environment, there will be no binding of that. This is another example of a ligand. It won't bind to the receptor proteins, and therefore the vesicles won't form. But if it is there, there will be binding. That will cause shape change in the receptor protein, like we've been talking about, and that will signal to the cell, I'm ready to be taken in. The cell invaginates or caves in the plasma membrane and forms a vesicle, receptor-mediated endocytosis. And that, I believe, finishes the unit. Yeah, it does. So, if you want to leave, that's fine. We're done. We have some extra moments if you want to ask me any questions about the tests. But don't feel that you have to, and don't feel that you have to stay even if someone else is asking questions. Yeah. Yeah, for receptor-mediated endocytosis, the cell is not going to bother going through the trouble of making a vesicle if the stuff it's wanting to import is not there in the environment. So it puts these receptors in its plasma membrane to test for whether they're there. And if they are there, those desired particles, then they will bind to the specific receptors that recognize the shapes of those things. And when that binding happens, that tells the cell, okay, now it's time to make a vesicle because the environment contains that stuff. Bring it in. It's another example of a ligand binding to a protein causing a shape change, a conformational change, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, well, the general answer here is, I mean, the three chapters are the three chapters, but you can kind of get an idea of, in any of my tests, of the likelihood of me asking you something about something based on how often I explain it to you. The more often I talk about something, the more likely it is there are going to be questions about that. But anything that I say in any of the recordings for these three chapters is fair game. That's the way to kind of gauge whether I'll ask, though. Yeah? They'll all be 50 questions. They'll all be A, B, C, D. And don't forget your Scantron. Also remember, when you come in this time, stay quiet as you come in because you can start immediately. Just sign in, get your test.